the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
As sure as eggs is eggs, the James Dyson Award has emerged yet again. And this year, of course, it's been a student-designed medical device that's won the major award. And we're delighted to actually welcome two of the team that actually were responsible for putting this fabulous thing into practice. That's Daniel and William. How are you guys?
Hi, very well, thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, hi, Alex. Nice to meet you.
Daniel, let's turn to you first. What was your inspiration behind this fantastic invention? And tell us a little bit about Pleural, a smart airway clearance device that performs chest physiotherapy.
Yeah, absolutely. So Pleural is, as you said, a smart airway clearance device. And the idea is that it's designed to help people manage chronic mucus. So chronic mucus is a condition that affects a lot of people. So this is kind of mucus that we might be familiar with building up to excessive levels and consistently to large volumes within the airways and within the lungs. And people who suffer from excess mucus often find it difficult to go about sort of daily activities. They might get very breathless. And they're also at a higher risk of infection, and that could lead to hospitalizations and some other kind of nastier conditions. So when we came together as Pleural, we decided that we really wanted to address some of the key issues being faced by people who suffer from excess mucus. We'd come into a master's program called Innovation Design Engineering, and we came together as a team kind of after the COVID pandemic had been affecting us all, and we realized how much it was affecting especially those people who we know who suffer from chronic lung conditions. So, for example, my grandmother, who has COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and that's a condition that affects many people, many older people. And people with COPD might suffer from excess mucus in the chest, and they might struggle to remember and perform the recommended airway clearance techniques that they were recommended by a medical professional. So we wanted to create something that could help them perform those techniques autonomously at home. And that's how we came up with Pleural, which is a device that does just that.
And Daniel, as you already mentioned, that was your grandmother who was responsible for inspiring you on that sort of thing. She must be fairly proud.
Yeah, she's very proud. So I let her know about the James Dyson Award win, and she was over the moon. Yeah, she was really helpful throughout the process. Obviously, someone that I was close to that we could kind of communicate with and get feedback from. And she was, just one of the many people that we worked with throughout the process of designing Pleural.
Will, let's turn to your good self, also a Royal College of Art student in terms of this. Was this something you were up for from the start, or was it a case of, well, I don't know, I mean, I'm a Royal College of Art student, what am I doing with engineers?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, coming from a background which neither as a designer or an engineer, joining the course, you do feel a bit of imposter syndrome, but that was kind of what really drew me to this incredible team, working with Dan, who was a fantastic engineer, Fergus, who worked as an architect, but also a very talented designer, and then Yihan, who has amazing industrial design experience. So I definitely felt very lucky to work as a team. But I do have to say, like, even though it is quite a big challenge, I think we were all very motivated to try and create something that was really impactful. And throughout the process, we were, as Dan was saying, speaking to a lot of people with different respiratory conditions. So people with COPD, cystic fibrosis, and were basically able to kind of talk to them, even go to their houses and really understand what the main problems were, what the main challenges were, in order to be able to come up with a solution that would actually make an impact. And so that's been a really amazing experience. It's not been easy, but it's been really fulfilling.
I'm pleased you mentioned Yihan and Fergus, of course. It was a fabulous foursome for a quartet of quality who effectively delivered this whole package. I mean, when you entered for the whole thing, did you feel confident that you were going to win? Was it something which you thought, yeah, let's go with this? Or was it just something that you thought, well, what the hey, we'll see what happens? Daniel?
Well, absolutely. We weren't confident that we would win. We were up against some amazing designs. And we've seen the James Dyson Award over the years. We've been following as designers, as engineers, as interested people in what's going on in innovation. And yeah, the amazing projects that come through. This year was no different. We know we were up against some amazing designers and innovators. We think our idea is pretty great and it can really make a positive impact to people. But we know that so many of the other designs that were entered will do the same in many different fields. So yeah, we're really over the moon. we didn't expect it, but we're really pleased to have been chosen.
As we said, the James Dyson Award is an international design award. It celebrates, encourages, and inspires the next generation of design engineers. Where are you going to go after this, Ritina? It's a case of, well, we've got our £5,000. That's it. It can get no better. Let's go to William first.
I think that's definitely not the case. I think winning the £5,000 from the James Dyson Award is actually even more motivating, and it's kind of given us a new fire to try and keep pursuing this. The next step is to basically take the money and to really build out a much more technically advanced prototype and get this in the hands of people. You know, as we've demonstrated Plural at different exhibitions and talked about it online, we have had countless numbers of people who are either, you know, directly affected by mucus or know people with the respiratory condition with excess mucus. There are 3.9 million people in the UK with mucus-related respiratory conditions, and they basically are asking us, you know, when can we get our hands on this? So I guess the next step for us is to try and build out this MVP, this prototype, and get it to a point where it's safe for people to use, and we can test it out and try it out and really validate that this could be something that helps a lot of people in the UK.
And Daniel, what advice would you give to anybody who might be listening to this, who might be a student at university college somewhere, or indeed might know somebody who might be part of the family? What advice would you actually have in terms of entering into the James Dyson Award scheme?
Yeah, well, definitely a simple piece of advice is just if you've designed something alongside the people that you're designing for, if it's been shown to potentially have some impact, positive impact on people, if you've got people around you telling it's really interesting, then apply. Why not? I mean, you've got nothing to lose. James Dyson Award is an amazing opportunity. And, you know, if you apply, if you don't win, it's a great opportunity to pitch to some amazing, talented designers. If you do win, well, I mean, the position we're in now is really exciting, and you can go on to do other amazing things. So yeah, just go for it. I think, if you've got something on your mind, if you've been working on something, it's a great opportunity to potentially show the world.
William, where can people find out more details about your award-winning project?
Yeah, so if you go on to, I'm going to mess this up, sorry, jamesdysonawards.org, you will be able to find the profile on the project, as well as find out more about the awards itself. And then to find out more about Plural directly from us, we're on social media, on Instagram. So if you just look for @plural.io, you'll be able to find regular updates from us there.
And Plural, of course, is spelled P-L-E-U-R-A-L, as opposed to simply being a multiple of more than one, basically. So it's a plural as in plural lungs and so on and so forth. Yeah. Gentlemen, it's been a joy connecting with the good self, Daniel Hale and Will Elliott. Huge thanks and congratulations once again, folks.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
There are those of us who will remember the very first iPhone. I know that's a shocking statement, but the fact of the matter was that little device that suddenly has created so much furore and excitement and maybe even joy and frustration over the years is now around to its, or approaching its latest incarnation, the iPhone 15. Clearly, we need to actually deconstruct this in a way that makes perfect sense to the listener and indeed to ourselves generally. So we're delighted to welcome Ace, technical expert extraordinaire, probably the best presenter the Gadget Show has ever had. It's Jason Bradbury. How are you, Jason?
Oh, you're so kind, my friend. That's only because I'm from Lincoln. That's the only reason you're saying that, but I'll take it anyway.
We've got to look after our own. Yellow bellies need to support on that basis.
We do.
That's critical on that side of things. And curiously, there isn't, as far as I'm aware, an iPhone yellow belly option as yet, but it may happen. Who knows?
Yeah, they need to sort that out. What there is with the new phone is a bunch of colours for the entry-level iPhone 15. So I forget exactly what colours they are, but I'm really taken with the all titanium bodies, or the titanium chassis at least, of the iPhone 15 Pro and Pro Max, which comes in titanium black and white blue, which is gorgeous. It's like a moonlight blue, and natural titanium. So that those are the colour options for the Pro versions, of which there are two in the new iPhone lineup.
And with Apple obviously announcing this new range of handsets and so on, is this a technophile's dream? Is it a case of, well, we love this? Does it become a kind of an object of beauty? Is it more less of a kind of functional IT device, more a kind of object of art? Or is it a mixture of all of those?
What was, I think it was Arthur C. Clarke said that any significantly advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And we're always looking for that awe moment, aren't we? We got that more, I would say, with the launch in June or the preview of the Vision Pro, their mixed reality or virtual reality helmet, which is coming next year. I wouldn't say that the new iPhone launch is on a par with that, but they're still, you know, they're still objects of beauty. They're still like functional jewelry, aren't they? Especially the titanium chassis. I think that's really, really beautiful. Interestingly, they're making a big push for sustainability. And my instinct tells me it's not just virtue signaling. I think there was real virtue in it. They're certainly attempting to reach some rather ambitious goals. The new Series 9 watches, the Apple watches that were also announced yesterday in California at the launch event, represent their first ever completely carbon neutral products. So again, we can be cynical of their motives or of their claims, but these are independently verified claims. And I think so we've got to go with them. There's lots of recycled materials, metals, cobalt, for example, in the new iPhones, but they haven't got that 100% carbon neutral moniker just yet. But they have got lots of new features. Would you like to know the features?
Well, could one of them possibly be a periscope camera?
Yeah, still don't quite know what that means, but what it relates to.
Presumably very useful if you're using your iPhone on a submarine, perhaps.
I was going to say, if you're in a 1940s black and white war movie, it could be really handy. But I think, it refers to the fact that the multivarious modes that you can use, the various camera arrays. So we talk about the iPhone camera, but really it's multiple cameras, isn't it? The ultra wide, the standard camera, various sort of depth sensors, etc. What they roll out into is seven lens options, if you like. This is my take on it. So if you've got your bag with your camera in it, let's say we're talking old school digital SLR or SLR or mirrorless camera, you might have three or four lenses in the bag, you know, like a 24 mil, 70 mil, 120 mil, whatever it is. So you've got from wide to close up macro lenses. Well, the phone operates in a similar way. They're defining their various modes as focal lengths now. And you can also assign your favorite focal length or zoom to within the settings, a default function, all right? So that you can start the phone up in a mode that maybe you use more generally. So for me, down in Cornwall now, which, by the way, is very sunny. Don't know what Lincoln's like today. Is it sunny?
Pretty sunny. It is pretty sunny. Right.
I love it. Nothing better than the bale in the sun. But maybe the Cornish coast. I don't know. But Anderby Creek actually comes to mind. But anyway, we're back on topic.
Let's not divert. Let's get on topic. Otherwise, iPhone will be most upset.
Let's say that you're popping down to the beach and you want to take, you know, pictures regularly, or maybe a bird sanctuary. You might want it to be by default in a particular mode. You can now do that. There's lots of personalization options actually across the iPhone 15 series, one of which is the action button. Have you heard about that? That's quite interesting. It's this switch that used to be to silence the phone or put it in vibration mode. Now it's just a single button that'll still do that, but it's also with other little gestures you can assign lots and lots of different phone functions to it. So you can take a picture with it or put the iPhone flashlight on more easily or start and stop a stopwatch, whatever it is. You can do that in the settings. That's quite nice. Something called the Dynamic Island is now available. It was launched on the iPhone 14 Pros. It's now available on all the 15s. There's a 15, just so that you know, there's a 15, there's a 15 Plus, there's a 15 Pro, and there's a 15 Pro Max. All have got this dynamic island. It's like a pill at the top of the screen on the front where the selfie camera is and some of the sensors, but it's actually like a mini screen now. So it's capable of showing data like a timer. So let's say that you set a timer for cooking and you're also watching a YouTube video about cooking the recipe that you've got in the kitchen. The timer carries on top. So it's like a screen within a screen. And there's lots of other cool things that you can do with it. Like it'll show your album art from the music that you're playing in your headphones or whatever. So that's quite nice. But it's USB 3. That's the headline news is about the retirement of the Lightning connector that they've been using for the last 11 years and its replacement with USB-C. Now, these headlines do need to be deciphered somewhat, though, because across the range, all iPhone 15s will have USB-C ports now, right? And I think that's good because it means that we're all now using devices, generally speaking, that are USB-C, not just Apple products, but all products. But you only get the really fast data that USB-C as a platform is capable of on the two Pro phones. That's 10 gigabits per second. It's considerably slower on the normal iPhone 15 and the iPhone 15 Plus. So just bear that in mind. But if you're taking super duper ProRes video, which is almost cinematic 4K quality video on this incredible new phone on the Pro version, or Pro RAW photos, for example, those file sizes can be enormous, can't they? And so you need that data throughput from the Pro level phones via the USB-C if you want to plug it into, like, let's say, a little miniature pocket-sized hard drive, or you want to transfer it onto your laptop with Windows on it, or your Apple MacBook, whatever it be. That data throughput is a big innovation, so I think that's probably worthy of its headline status.
Well, I think looking at the headlines, I'm also particularly impressed, and you mentioned this earlier in terms of sustainability, that the battery life of the iPhone 15 is designed to last almost 20% longer than current models. I mean, that must be a boon for people who kind of have challenges when it comes to making sure their phone is fully charged.
Yeah, I think it's important. It's certainly a big factor, isn't it, in terms of sustainability scores, if you're doing the complicated mathematics of trying to verify what the impact of these various devices is, both in terms of manufacturing, materials, efficiency of the silicon, and the battery life, how much electricity it takes, you know, if you have to have a day's use, whether you've got to plug it in again and draw yet more electrons. These are all important. And it's often down to two interesting factors, one of which in part might be the use of titanium in the two Pro models of the iPhone 15. So not the iPhone 15 and iPhone 15 Plus, but the Pro and the Pro Max are titanium chassis. Now, titanium is not just a very luxurious material. It's very beautiful. It's got a kind of gunmetal luster to it. But it's also very good thermally, and it's light. So they reckon both those phones are between 8 and 9% lighter than their equivalent phones in the iPhone 14 and some of the previous models before that. So getting lighter, which is good, because they often get heavier, don't they? You know, these iPhone... these smartphones, especially the bigger ones, the Mac size ones, can get a bit heavy. They're also not using leather anymore in terms of materials. We were talking about sustainability materials. They're not using leather for the iPhone range now, or for the, I'm talking about the accessories, obviously, or for the Apple Watches. They're using a kind of fine weave fabric that they say has a sort of suede texture. But again, I've not been hands-on, so I can't give you any personal feedback on that.
Yeah. And clearly, just looking ahead to 2024, I noticed that there are rumors that the iPhone 15 Ultra model is going to be heading towards us. Why shouldn't it be easy just to go to an iPhone 16 as opposed to an iPhone 15 Ultra?
Well, you get this every year, don't you? You know, you've got to look at the spec and you've got to make a decision about whether it does what you need it to do. And for me, I always want in, you know, they say the best camera is the one that you've got in your hand. Yeah. And so if I've not got my posh mirrorless camera, because I'm always filming content, video and pictures, it's the one you've got in your hand. And if that's your smartphone, then you want it to be as good as possible, don't you? And this new camera array is really good. It's very intuitive. There's some great functions that the silicon does as well. Part of that chip, the A17 Pro on the Pro iPhone 15s, is something called a neural engine. And it's this thing that you might have seen on previous phones, iPhones, where you can... Let's say I took a picture of you in your studio. I could touch you and it would automatically cut you out and I could put you in a different on a different background.
Then you're into all sorts of, is it real? Is it?
Oh, my goodness.
Where's the ChatGPT factor in this?
I think it's part of that. I mean, the neural engine uses machine learning, which, as you know, is part of AI. So you're not actually wrong. But it also does other cool stuff. So when you make a phone call, for example, the neural engine is now capable on the iPhone 15s of, if you want it to, cleaning up the background noise, getting rid of it and enhancing your vocal quality. So here's a weird thing. It's actually a phone. And I think it should probably, if they're to be believed, do a better job of phone calls. So there's a thing. But if you want, I mean, just so that you know, if you want to look at the spec and you want to check out the network to put the phone on, ee.co.uk is a great place to start.
Jason, as ever, absolute perfection. Anybody who can actually drop in an Arthur C. Clarke law, specifically related to magic, is always impressive from my point of view.
Oh, brilliant.
Keep on keeping on, and hopefully we'll see you again in Lincoln before too long.
Oh, yeah. It won't be long till I'm up. Enjoy the sun today.
Time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
There's a word in Korean, inyeon. It means providence or fate.
Do you believe in that?
That's just something Koreans say to seduce someone.
What a good story this is. Childhood sweethearts who reconnect 20 years later and realize they were meant for each other. In the story, I would be the evil white American husband standing in the way of destiny.
Shut up. He was just this kid in my head for such a long time. I think I just missed him.
Did he miss you?
Hae-sung!
Wow, 너다.
Wow.
Wow.
진짜 와다.
Wow. Not really sure how to feel about it, son. And the way you move makes me feel like I can't live without you.
뭐가? 그냥 너랑 얘기하는 거?
The guy flew 13 hours to be here. I'm not gonna tell you that you can't see him or something.
만약에 네가 한국을 떠나지 않았다면 내가 널 찾았을까? 우리가 사귀었을까? 헤어졌을까? 부부가 됐을까? 아이들을 가졌을까?
너는 나를 왜 찾았어?
한 번 더 보고 싶었어.
If two strangers walk by each other in the street and their clothes accidentally brush, that means there have been 8,000 layers of inyeon between them.
Want you to stay. Want you to stay.
And so we begin, thanking Jason Bradbury, of course, for his contribution to the latest iPhone. Well, not so much his contribution as the sort of curator of the iPhone, but as a technical expert, really. Will you be going for the iPhone 14 or will you be waiting for the iPhone 15? You can only decide. And thanks also to our successful fine folk, of course, from this year's James Dyson Award. But as the ident has actually just said, we are in that period of the programme which leads us to the Natasha Wanton, Richard Fitzwilliam slot, with, of course, added Dutch impact with Fia van den Bogert. How are you, Fia?
Thank you.
Good. Yeah. Excellent. And before Richard actually arrives, Natasha wants to move straight in without any sort of notion of inyeon or any other Korean notions of past lives, etc., to the latest Agatha Christie incarnation. And indeed, did it make you jump, Natasha, or were you safely and securely guided through the movie?
My husband did a very good job of safely guiding me through the movie, but I will go on about the jump scares in a little bit. I'll start with a bit of a synopsis and background, as I usually do, before Richard gets here and can poo-poo the whole thing. So this is based on a lesser kind of known Agatha Christie novel. It's actually titled Halloween Party. And they've obviously changed the name for the name of the movie. It is a sequel to Death on the Nile, being the third movie in the Kenneth Branagh kind of remakes. The first two of which, to recap for the listener, I gave nines to both the first and the
if only for Kenneth Branagh's mustache as Hercule Poirot, presumably.
I really enjoy Kenneth Branagh as Poirot. I like the kind of sass that he has in the role. I know Richard is not so much of a fan.
He's in the camp of David Suchet because he's a friend of David Suchet, so just let it go at that.
Bless him. But yeah, so I thought the release date of this movie was rather strange. So it was released officially in the US on the 15th of September, and it's kind of been available worldwide, I believe. I question whether or not it probably would have been better to release it next month, what with Halloween coming up. They seem to be doing this at the minute. It seems to be very silly. They did this as well with Haunted Mansion that came out at the end of August. So I'm not sure why they're putting all of these spooky-esque movies sort of earlier. But anyway, so this story is very much trying to kind of restore and reinvigorate Poirot and his character, because he's sort of down on his luck as we sort of meet him at the start of this movie. So having lost his faith kind of in humanity, he's sort of living this quiet life in Venice. Just after the war, it's 1947, and he's employed this ex-police officer, Vital Portfoglio. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Nobody from Italy, please, please, please. I hope I haven't offended you. So on Halloween, he gets a visit from his old friend, Ariadne Oliver. And she's a famous sort of murder mystery author. And she sort of twists his arm and invites him to this seance at the palazzo of a famous opera singer, Rowena Drake. And it's sort of set up as this idea that Ariadne doesn't really believe that she's got, you know, real medium powers, but and she wants to prove her wrong and she needs Poirot to help her. So that's the sort of what Poirot's fed. So they go along to this party after what is a very weirdly scary and inappropriate story for children about the background of the palazzo. Talking about children getting locked up during plague and starving and now hunting doctors and nurses. And yeah, I'm not sure I would want if I had a 7-year-old, I'd want them to sit through that. But anyway, we sort of get to the seance scene where Poirot kind of deduces that there's a bit of fraud going on. He sort of finds one of her assistants up a chimney who's got this magnetic device who's making the typewriter move. However, suddenly Miss Reynolds starts speaking in a voice that isn't hers, which, you know, Rowena claims to be the voice of her dead daughter. And it's revealed that apparently Alicia, the daughter, did not commit suicide, but was thrown to her death and murdered. And before it can sort of reveal who the murderer is, the whole thing is stopped. Miss Reynolds sort of snaps out of it and is sort of brought back to herself. And she's rather smug about the whole thing, thinking that she's tricked Poirot, because Poirot can't kind of really work out what's going on and how she managed to do it. Unfortunately, 5 minutes later, after this, in terms of timeline of the movie, she ends up dead, sort of skewered on top of a statue. And it's all rather nasty because the storm started and they're all sort of locked in the building. And now suddenly Poirot, who's given up and retired, now has another murder mystery case that he's been thrown into. What sort of happens and how this sort of thing unpacks, I won't give spoilers for. I will say with the sort of investigation, compared to the other two, it was for me much more obvious who did it in this one, which is probably why I will go to a lower score than the other two. I sort of worked it out within the first round of interviews. So I don't know if that's sort of matching the plot of the book, if that's as obviously written in the book Halloween Party, but the way that they portrayed it in the screen, it's kind of a bit more obvious with the way that they portrayed the characters. I do like the characters. I do find the performances interesting. You've got Carl Allen, you've got Jamie Doran, you've got Tina Fey, you've got Jude Hill.
There's and, some very and let's interesting face it, Kenneth Branagh is infinitely superior to Mr. Suchet in the role of Poirot. I mean, this is clearly, you know, a done deal, as you outlined.
Alex, you don't even carry convincingly with that phrase. You don't believe that, do you? No. Just to provoke me.
I do really enjoy Branagh's kind of energy with his sort of counterpart Ariadne in this play. I think that it was played by Tina Fey. I do think that the pairing of the two of them together, they've got good chemistry on screen, which helps the plot. I think my main issue, I generally really enjoyed the film. I was surprised to see Michelle Yeoh in the movie. was like, oh, okay, you're popping up. That's
Agatha Christie has written an awful lot of roles for Korean actresses and Asian actresses as well, really. It's part and parcel of the whole piece.
I was quite surprised. I think my main issue with the film is that because when you've got like a Poirot kind of murder mystery, it's very much kind of everything is sort of meticulous and everything has a reason why it happens, and you see all the logic and everything unpacking within that. With this, I think because they wanted to go down that more spooky, that more spiritual ooky kooky kind of vibe, it was trying to add a little bit of that and a little bit of openness with that. I won't obviously reveal too much because I don't want to ruin the ending and what happens, but I feel like it had a little bit of an identity crisis more so in this movie, because it couldn't quite decide whether it wanted to stick to that factual, oh, Scooby-Doo kind of taking off the mask, no, ghosts aren't real, and more of trying to slip in those scarier supernatural undertones. And I think that's my main criticism of the movie, and that's why it's costed a couple of points. Did I find it scary? I think because you think it is a Poirot movie, you don't expect the supernatural side of it to be real, because you're sort of are waiting for that moment where it's revealed that, oh, this is all smoke and mirrors. So maybe if they wanted to do more of a scarier tone of the movie, and they did try to put in some of those classic horror movie kind of jump scares and plots and sort of and staging and camera shots and stuff. But it, because of the type of movie it is, and you know it's Poirot, it didn't really succeed in actually being scary. And that's quite a lot for me to admit, because I don't do horror. Like, I get jumpy real, real quick. CSI has me, like, just jumpy. But this was, it wasn't scary. I think it was intended to be scary, which again...
A Haunting in Venice, are you giving it 8 out of 10 then, Natasha?
I think I am giving it 8 out of 10. Bear in mind, I gave 9 to the other two. I did generally, as I say, overall enjoy this movie and the story and the characters. I found it quite interesting. But as I said, I'm knocking off points because, A, as I say, I guessed who done it in the first round of interviews that he did. And I also found that it had that identity crisis between the supernatural and the kind of factual.
Well, yeah. Indeed. But as I say, thank the Lord, Kenneth Branagh is actually now the accepted quintessential Hercule Poirot, probably seconded by Albert Finney, with David Suchet coming in, probably a low third after that. Fia van den Bogert in Balk in the Netherlands. Are you a fan of Hercule Poirot? Is it a case of why would I support a Belgian detective?
I have to confess that I have never heard of him. So I can't really say anything about it, but I did want to ask Natasha, haven't you just gotten too good at guessing who the murderer is?
Maybe I might have done. I don't know. I do really like murder mysteries. I do get really invested. Me and my husband, it's kind of like our cute little nerdy, like that's like our movie, like little sweet spot. And we like to guess who did it. I don't know. Something about the phrasing of the dialogue, maybe, because it felt the first round of interviews and I was like, oh, I think it's her. And
Oh no.
It's all right, Natasha. I mean, you know, as we like to know, I mean, Richard always gives spoilers away, so you're perfectly at liberty drop in a few other sort of areas.
That is a deeply shocking lie, Alex. It does you discredit.
Sarah Huntley, who's obviously in a costume now, which could be taken from an Agatha Christie routine, is A Haunting in Venice something which you think, given Natasha's relatively positive review on that side of things, is that something you're going to wait for and say yes, because I love everything that Kenneth Branagh does?
I'm going to say an absolute yes, because I love Poirot. You are wrong, but you are right. And so therefore, Natasha, think about that. I think Poirot is fantastic. And I know what Natasha is saying. It's not something you equate supernatural with a Poirot immediately. Perhaps a bit more an Agatha Christie would. And then you find out the ghost was a bit of a joke or a bit of a shield for something else. So I find that very interesting. Personally, I love that sort of genre and style because it's escapism. And it's one of the few types of films that make me totally engage with it and stop getting stressed, actually. So if I watched, as I adored The Innocents, I'm so sorry, I was driving and I couldn't connect and I stopped to not connect to everybody last week. But The Innocents was fantastic and I definitely give that a 10 and a half. Sorry, jumping back. But to this, I think why I brought in The Innocents from last week is it was brilliant, but I start getting stressed on behalf of them. But for this, the Agatha Christie, for the Poirot, for me, it represents completely escaping into a different world and they're their problems, not my problems. And I find it fascinating. And I love murder. I just adore murder mysteries. I think they're fantastic.
As long as David Suchet isn't in the lead role as Poirot.
Heavens, Alex. No, worse.
You can't say that. I'm sorry, Richard, back me up here. I'm finishing talking, I promise we'll go. But I'm sorry, that was the thing I disagreed with, Alex. David Suchet, out of all the Poirots, would get my top vote. Thank you very much. But I cannot agree with your rating of the other Poirots.
He didn't actually, Sarah, all Alex was doing was stirring. I don't believe that he thinks that. We may never be told. Indeed, we can't know. But as far as Poirot's concerned, and what, I mean, Natasha obviously had a lot of enjoyment in The Haunting of Venice. And I mean, I haven't seen it yet. I hope to see it for next week. But here's the big but. As far as I'm concerned, yes, the Poirot's David Suchet, then Peter Ustinov. I didn't like Albert Finney, but those are the main Poirots.
And unfortunately, as Richard doesn't really like Roger Moore as James Bond, he disenfranchises himself from a Poirot reading. Let's move on, because Inyan is all about past lives, a whole notion of probably the best movie of 2023. Yes, you could take A Haunting in Venice, but here we are, Oscar awards obviously forthcoming. It's A Haunting in Venice. It's better than Richard Linklater's Views and his Beyond Sunset, Beyond Sunrise, and various other elements.
I love those. Absolutely, they are superb of their sort. I would not compare them.
But I'm sure you'll actually be delighted to actually sing the praises of another South Korea entry into the genre of everything everywhere all at once, although a lot more calmer.
Well, I mean, I think that Past Lives, yes, indeed, it has got awards traction, directed by Celine Song, and very, very interesting, the structure of this film, because the story is told in flashbacks. You get a very cleverly staged opening where we are very briefly introduced to its characters. We don't get to know them until a good deal later. Essentially, it depicts the relationship between two people, both, yes, from the same cultural background, from Korea, over a period of 24 years. So the way the story is told, and also the visuals, and also the script, and the performances make this, I thought, a perfect movie. We first meet Na Young, played by Greta Lee, and Hae Song, played by Tiu Yeo, when they're 12-year-old childhood sweethearts. And then he's rather upset. Her family emigrates to the United States. And then there's a gap of 12 years. She has become Nora. Nora is a writer. She's living in New York. And she discovers that he tried to get in contact with her on Facebook. The two subsequently connect on Skype. And then they talk regularly. But she tells them that the chats are starting to distract her. She wanted a different life in the States. She had different ambitions. She's about to go to a writer's retreat. He's going to China as part of a language exchange, so they're not going to meet. And then the conversation ceases. Subsequently, it's another 12 years. Now, at the retreat, Nora meets Arthur, played by John Magaro, and describes the Korean concept of a past life and meeting in that past life and how you relate to someone during
Inyan. Inyan, Richard. That's the word, Inyan.
It is. Hae Song has an affair, but 12 years later, he's single and he visits New York. And then we meet Nora again. She's a playwright. She's married to Arthur, an author. She's been married for 8 years. They're relatively happy together, but he feels there are parts of her that he cannot, I mean, he's thinking of learning Korean, he hasn't got very far, as it transpires, he can't reach. So when Hai Jong joins Nora and Arthur for an evening out, we've seen clips, a brief clip of this at the very beginning of the film, the chemistry becomes intense. They communicate in Korean, which Arthur doesn't know. Hai Sung doesn't speak much English. And tension builds as we await what actually happens. Now, one of the reasons I loved this film, it's a rumination on fate. It illustrates the strength of ties such as the as language in the Asian diaspora. And different parts of one's life can have a very special meaning. One of the things that was fascinating here was the silences in parts of this film. It's a very eloquent testimony to hidden thoughts. And again, a literate script, exquisitely composed visuals, perfect casting, I thought. It's a move piece, and it's a puzzle that gradually unfolds and enriches you whilst you watch it. Greta Lee, very sensitive performance as Nora, a woman with two men in her past lives. Hai Jong, he fears he's too ordinary, but his impassive features hide deep emotions. Tio Yeo, superb. John Magara's Arthur is excellent. And paradoxically, in this movie, he is the outsider, despite being Jewish and in New York, which is, of course, his hometown. How this fascinating human triangle resolves itself, well, even the most hard-hearted will be moist-eyed. I mean, the diverse theme, the cross-cultural appeal, characters, a microcosm of an increasingly globalized world, definitely awards material.
It's like living through an 18-month affair in a course of an hour and three quarters, according to Peter Bradshaw, writing in The Guardian. Also five stars, Fia van den Bogert, in terms of fate, past lives. How many times we've done this connection, who knows? Your thoughts on this one? Is this something which you think, yes, as a Dutch citizen, I want to find out more about the Korean experience in New York City?
Yes, definitely. And not just about the Korean experience, but really about those people and how everyone wonders about a past life. And if I had made a different decision, would my life be different? And how would life continue? And I think that's I think the movie did that really well, and it really shows how one decision can change your life. So was it? I think Dutch people will love this movie.
Natasha,
it definitely sounds like a really deep and interesting sort of concept, and I'd really like to sink my teeth into this one. I think I'd be interested to see how it does do sort of with the awards coming up, kind of contrasting to what's happened in previous years. But no, I definitely want to watch it before then, so I can sit there and smile as it's getting hopefully the awards that Richard says it deserves.
Maybe we should just let it go. Sarah Huntley, your thoughts on this one. Is it one for your good self, or is it a case of, well, you know, we just have to live life in the now? If we're constantly tractioned back by what's gone in the past, basically we're never going to progress at all.
Don't be so negative, Alex. No, I think this is a must too. And I agree with what the girls have been saying. I think it's fascinating in life, like Sliding Doors, the film, you know, the choice you make at that time has a journey. But I believe that things are meant. And I would say why I would like to go and see this as well as just that is that everybody in their lives, different people come and go at different times. And so I would say perhaps from my point of view, what I'd be interested in is the time lapse and how people never really go, even those you've lost. They're always with you. And I think that as you, I'm not going to say get older, as you acquire more years, you suddenly find that somebody that you haven't seen for a long time in your 20s is very significant and you see a lot of in your latter years. And I think this film is probably dealing with that. And that also, it's very rare as you get older, I think, to really make another firm friend. But that does happen, like Fitzwilliams. But you know, but it's, I think, Richard, if you back me up here, Alex, I'm sure you agree, but you get different. I mean, Alex has always been a permanent fixture in my life, since a murder mystery, in fact. But
it's all connected, Sarah, inevitably.
That's what I'm trying to say. It's all connected. And I think the girls have summed it up brilliantly, that actually you just don't know how it's going to keep the carousel of friends is going to keep going round. But they're always there. It just changes slightly with how your life is being at certain times. And I think this is fascinating. And looking back and thinking, gosh, if I'd done that then, would I be here now? Or had I not had a daughter, what would have happened? Or had I, you know, there's pros and cons in everything. So I love this kind of theme. I'm definitely going to go and see it before it's on Netflix.
If only the Russians hadn't decided to invade the Ukraine, if only Ukrainian journalists hadn't actually been trapped in Mariupol for 20 days producing a documentary at the same time. If only, Richard, is this another one of those areas where you're thinking, maybe we just need to go back to the notion of forgiveness, because if we don't forgive, we'll never forget. And as a result of that, we'll go round and round.
Well, I can only say, Alex, that I don't see a great deal of forgiveness when you have seen what I can only describe as a descent into a human hell like this. I mean, the Associated Press team of Ukrainian journalists courageously documents the initial part. It lasted for 86 days. This is 20 days in Mariupol, the eastern port city in Ukraine. And while they've certainly made an unforgettable film, it depicts the terrors of life in a besieged city in a ferociously powerful way. Filmed, written, directed by Mstislav Chernov, almost unbelievably, I have to say, his first feature film. He also narrates it. The photographer is Evgeny Malatletka. The sounds throughout the film, really superb. This does draw you in because the explosions, the sights, the sounds of war. I mean, this is real and it has that immediacy. I mean, it intentionally makes watching this a very, very unpleasant experience. I mean, the transformation of the city, we've all seen shots of it, I think, once thriving with over 400,000 inhabitants, now a burnt-out wreck destroyed by bombing and shell fire. Finally, it's still captured by the Russians, they still occupy it. 25,000 estimated died in the siege, and they deprived the city of electricity, water, fuel. This crew was the only one left to report what was happening, how the city was dying. And one of the problems was getting out footage, outside connections of any sort, so they could get the video footage out, was very, very tenuous. And that's a problem throughout. But it's what they produce that's so important, because this is ferociously damning evidence of Russian atrocities. I mean, the sequences in this film, the problem is who's going to go and see it? Because the scenes are so deeply harrowing. When there's a maternity hospital bombed and you see a pregnant woman fatally injured, you see a father weeping for his mutilated son, you see devastating footage of infants slaughtered, bodies found in the streets, tumbled into mass graves. I mean, blood is quite literally everywhere, and you've got this immediacy where the doctors, with dwindling medical supplies, are trying to save lives during the shelling and the bombing and so forth. Gutted buildings on fire, traumatized individuals, shops being looted. I mean, it really is terrifying. The United Nations has screened it a few days ago to 100 people, including the American ambassador. It won an award at Sundance. As I say, there is a problem to get people to watch something as harrowing as this, even though it's 94 minutes. There's a doctor quoted, "War is like an X-ray. All human innards are visible. Good people become better. Bad people become worse." Well, I mean, it's a visceral documentary. This is a Golgotha I think only humans could create. Yes, I mean, it's essential viewing for anyone who can be prepared to see this sort of thing because it is what has happened, tragically.
100% Rotten Tomatoes rating. I'm not sure whether you can actually use something along those lines. And it seems almost crass to start discussing and debating it. Sadly, we don't have Kathy Manso to provide her input, given that she's obviously been in Ukraine and still heading over there. But let's turn to Fia again. Fia, any thoughts on 20 Days in Mariupol?
Yes, well, I think this movie really shows how terrible war can be and how war just doesn't really help anyone. And the people in Mariupol were just unlucky to live in Mariupol. And I mean, luckily we live in the Netherlands or in the UK, but we could have been there and just died because we had an apartment in some building or we're in a hospital, and it's just completely unfair. And yeah, I think this movie, it's great to show it's important to show what a war can be and to teach people that this is not something that you want and it doesn't help anyone.
We clearly have natural disasters, Morocco, of course, and other North African countries suffering badly with respect to that, Libya and so on. Natasha Wanton, you're in Australia. Again, natural disasters occur. This is clearly human-made, man-made, whatever the line happens to be. Talked about forgiveness. Any thoughts on this one for yourself? Is it a movie you will be checking out?
Oh, definitely. It's movies like this and sort of stories like this, which is why I fell in love with journalism. It's why I studied journalism because, you know, at the end of the day, we are this fourth estate and there's so many terrible things that happen in the world. And it is harrowing and from just listening from Rich's description, it's probably going to be one of those movies that's going to haunt you for some time. But it's still really important, I think, that a lot of people go out and see this because this is real and this is what's happening. And as hard as it is sometimes to look out into the world and see what's happening, we still need to look. We can't turn away because people are dying and injustice is happening. And that's when I think journalism and why I get really passionate about this kind of stuff, because it's really important that these brave souls do what they do and keep doing what they do in these dark times, because, you know, there's humanity and stuff in that as well. And people can then, you know, mobilize and do things about it because they see the injustice that's happening. I mean, you look at what happened with the Vietnam War and it being, you know, the most, it was incredibly documented at the time. And from that, you got a lot of popular pressure, you got a lot of mobilization of the masses, and hopefully, you know, through injustice and stuff that is happening here, it can kind of mobilize the international community to put on more pressure if it's whatever it's going to do. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be from a military perspective, but it could be economic. It could be however it wants to put that pressure. But it's important that people know about it so that change can happen and so that people don't feel like they're isolated on their own, because if we don't know that the injustice is happening, then we can't correct it.
Sarah.
But I agree entirely with Theo and Natasha, and I'd say you can't almost classify this as a film. I think it's everyone's duty to go and see it because it's a documentation of what's happening, and it will be very important in years to come. And what it's reminding me of is in the Second World War, when people, we didn't have so much coverage, and then the first revealing of what the concentration camps were. I mean, that's a very important documentation now of actually what was happening, and this will, I think, act in the same way. And I agree with Natasha, I can see why, that's why she's gone into what she has, because it's not really just a film, it's about the future, hopefully future generations seeing what, you know, saying what war can do and how awful it is. Plus, another thought that occurs to me is, might it be possible that this actually could get to Russia? Because I had an interesting conversation with a pupil this week who went to Russia for his holidays. You know, need I say more? And that is somebody of mixed Ukrainian-Russian blood. But I feel guilty because this war has gone on for such a long time now. We are getting used to it as being something that is happening rather than, you remember, the first months, weeks. And I think that I can't see how Ukraine can keep going, even with the help of everybody. It's exhausting. And if only this were to be leaked to Russia, perhaps a few more Russians would have the nerve to go against Putin, because I don't know how this is going to end. But I think it's a marvelous thing, and I will make myself go and see this unless just everybody else does. I think it's really important.
And so we head towards the London Film Festival. Richard, have you got your tickets for that? Are you looking forward to actually accessing Saltburn? Obviously a great movie, based on a great place in the northeast of England, no doubt. And are you keenly anticipating more wonderment for the London Film Festival 2023?
Well, one of the problems, my commitments, Alex, so far, I haven't involved myself in the festival as I have in previous years. It's just the balance of things and just certain commitments, especially over the weekends of the film festival. So probably not this year, but I will be catching up on the film subsequently. Absolutely. There's a lot to see.
Well, there we are. We've gone from the quintessential Poirot, unknown in Holland, obviously, and why would any Dutch people ever have any awareness as to this Belgium detective, as I said earlier? But of course, the incarnation of Kenneth Branagh with superbly waxed moustache, Natasha. Does the moustache exhibit any poltergeistic signs of activity and separation from Poirot, or does it actually remain fixed on his face throughout?
I mean, it'd be a very entertaining movie if it didn't. But I feel like we would then drift more into the Scooby-Doo realms, and we'd sort of be wanting to see Rowan Atkinson and various other people involved rather than that's more of a Haunted Mansion, which is what I reviewed a couple of weeks ago, rather than maybe a Poirot movie.
I think when his moustache, I think it was the Orient Express, and he had these sort of squirrel-like features.
It was a character in itself, Richard. And deserves credit just for that alone. But to Richard Fitzwilliam, to Natasha Wanton, to Fia Vandenberger and Sarah Huntley, huge thanks, and keep watching the movies.